There's got to be an explanation to all these UFO sightings, right? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Hollywood Casino in Charlestown, West Virginia. April's featured entertainment includes Los Lobos on the 12th, Josh Turner on the 13th, and The Steel Woods on the 26th. Details and tickets at HollywoodCasinoCharlestown.com. Must be 21 to enter the casino floor and attend a show. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Welcome to the newest episode of Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. I'm your host, Jason Fraley, picking the brains of the top filmmakers, musicians, and artists of our time. Jennifer Esposito visits the Annapolis Film Festival in Maryland this Friday to screen Fresh Kills, her new mafia movie told entirely from the women's perspective. She joined me to discuss her decades-long journey to write and direct her first feature film, as well as playing the mother of Emily Bader, who also joined the call. Hey, Jennifer Esposito and Emily Bader, hey, thanks for joining us on WTOP in DC.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
Yes, we're talking to, as I mentioned, Jennifer Esposito, the writer, director, and star of Fresh Kills, the new, I guess we'll call it a gangster movie, but it's so much more than a drama. And also Emily Bader, the star who plays, you know, one of your daughters in the movie. It opens at the Annapolis Film Fest on Friday, April 5th for folks in our area. I just watched it and I really, really enjoyed it. But remind us, where are we on the festival circuit? Where does Annapolis fall here?
So we premiered first at Tribeca in June, and we have been, I don't even know, we've been to so many film festivals. We picked up quite a few awards. We're very proud. And Annapolis is one of the later film festivals before we release in the late spring, early summer.
Awesome. And we have a release date yet? Is it May 17th, I think?
No, it's looking like June 14th now.
Okay, IMDb needs to get their act together, update it.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, I like I said, I really, really enjoyed it. But in order for me to use the soundbite, it's better if I have one of you take the explain the basic premise. So give me the basic, you know, log line of where it's set, who the characters are, the basic setup.
Sure. So basically, the movie takes place in Staten Island. Which was a very, very big mafia place of families moving from Brooklyn to Staten Island in the late 80s, 90s. And it takes place around this one particular family called the LaRusso family. And Emily Bader is actually the lead, who is on with us. And she plays a young woman named Rose. And it's basically her discovery of who and what her family is really involved in. And like you said, it is in the mafia genre, but it really, really is so much more than that. It's more about finding a voice in a world that tells you not to have one. And Rose, being born into such a life, she asked the question of, you know, what choice did I have in this? What did I have to say in this and be in this this family and this situation of being a mafia guy's daughter and everything that comes along with that? So that's the gist of the movie.
Awesome. Well described. It's almost like you wrote it.
Almost.
One more for you, Jennifer, before we have Emily jump in here to talk about Rose. I just like sort of like you said, I really love that yes, it's in the mafia world, but that it's told entirely from the perspective of the women in the movie, both you as the mother slash wife and also the daughters. Of course, they're coming of age through discovering all of this. Talk about, your inspiration to sort of tackle that genre that's, you know, has so many legendary movies, but from a different perspective. I mean, The Godfather,
Goodfellas, they're masterpieces. You know, they're The Sopranos. I guess they kind of showed, you know, Edie Falco's character, you know, a little bit, you know, as a supporting character. But even that was still Tony's show. And then there's like newer ones, like, you know, The Irishman. Again, Scorsese's a master, but I remember my wife and I walking out and be like, there were really not that many strong female characters in that, as good as the rest was. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. What's your reaction when, you know, when you've been watching these decades of these, you know, these great movies, but at the same time, you're like, man, we need a little agency here.
It's about change. And so many people are very afraid of change, but I was determined to push this through. And I have to tell you, it has been a struggle from day one, because for a female to not only insert herself into a very masculine genre, which it's been completely done by men. We've also seen the male point of view ad nauseam. And yes, everything that you mentioned are wonderful, wonderful pieces of work, but we never see the female's point of view in that world. And I happened to grow up around those women, and they had voices, and they had lives, and they had dreams, and they had desires, and none of it is ever talked about on screen. So it was it's been a happy challenge for me to bring this out and be able to share a different perspective in such a male-dominated genre. So it was just a very important thing for me to do.
Absolutely. So basically, you're saying that, you know, Al Pacino, Michael Corleone, and his henchmen, as they, you know, remember, they closed the door on Diane Keaton in that sort of symbolic Coppola final image. Your idea is sort of open that door and look the other way from the woman's perspective.
Well, there's a part in the movie in which you understand, and the people that see it will recognize. So, in The Sopranos, in the Godfather, all of these famous mafia tropes, you see the men at the table, and you see these characters that you know, and they're always at the table plotting something, and you see like a woman's hand come in and leave pastry, or you see a woman in the back and she's happens to be naked on a pole dancing. In this film, especially, there is one scene where you see that table and you're reminded of those characters that you know, but you see who's watching that table, and it's his daughter. It's the
Exactly.
daughter watching her dad in this world. So I thought, like I said, yes, we saw a little bit with Edie Falco, but what I'm really looking at is the daughters. And mezzo soprano wasn't depicted, in my opinion, from what I saw growing up, correct. So it was like, let's really see what the young women go through in a family like this.
Absolutely. Well, perfect segue to bring Emily Bader in here because, yes, like you said, you pretty much become the lead of the movie. And yeah, I know there's different other, I guess, child actors that play the two sisters at younger ages, etc. But Emily, you really do, you know, for the majority of, you know, in the meat of the movie, you become the lead as Rose. Just talk about, you know, getting to work on this and sort of that connection that you have with your on-screen sister. We're not going to spoil anything of what happens with the two of you by the end, but there is a huge bond between the two of you and sort of a different approach to accepting the bakeries and accepting this life and marriage proposals. Like your character, Emily, don't you think is a little more like, I want to go my own way, whereas your other sister's like happy to revel in the life.
I think, so she's the youngest of the two sisters, and her older sister, played by Odessa, who's Connie, is sort of becoming a product of this society and this sort of violent family. But I think Rose has a very tumultuous mind, living with in this constant state of being on the edge, and it just doesn't settle well with her. So I think the way that she's always coped with it is through silence, but as she gets older and through this film, as we see her sort of dealing with it in different ways, it's like she's almost suffocating in her own silence, in her inability to say, well, I actually don't think this is right, and this is not the life that I want to live, but do I have a choice? What hard decisions do I have to make, and can I make them? Is it possible for me to make them?
That's right.
Well said. And I want to dive a little more into sort of the relationship as mother daughter that the two of you, while I have you both on this interview, this is really cool to get to talk to both of you. You know, it's a couple moments between mother and daughter that really stand out and carry the movie, if you ask me. I love the moment And it's a lot of like unsaid stuff. It's just like nods and glances and stuff. But like at the wedding, when you get proposed to, Emily, as Rose, you don't really even say yes or no to the guy proposing. You kind of are like in shock and stare at your mother for a cue. And Jennifer Esposito, you're kind of like nodding and hugging her like, yes, it's okay to say yes. Like, but talk about sort of that moment where you're kind of, I don't know, it's not a Michael Fredo embrace, but it's like a hug where you're like pulling her into the lifestyle when really she's trying to get out.
That's basically it. It's in that world, but I'm pushing you to look at some of the things in our world that things are set up for you. And if you're female, this is the road you're supposed to take. You're supposed to get married, you're supposed to have children, and what else would you want? And that's all Francine knew, my character. That's all she understood. So she was, you know, I don't like to say, you know, Francine loves her daughter and wants the best for her, but maybe not better than what she was able to achieve. So there's a lot of generational stuff going on there as well. So again, it was constantly taking Rose's voice away and her choices. And it was such a, I mean, working with Emily has been an absolute dream. When I started thinking about this probably 25 years ago, and throughout my career, I went back and forth with going in and writing. And I always had, you know, in the beginning, of course, I wanted to play Rose. And I have to say, throughout the writing, and I cannot think of anyone that is not more Rose than Emily. So it was just so wonderful to be able to play with someone that I created and to see it visually come to life in Emily Bader. It was pretty extraordinary.
You know, and we're so fortunate in this, because I think, as Jen said, she wrote this role to sort of off experience and for yourself. And yet we rarely had, you know, we were on the same page a lot of the time instinctually about what felt right about this character. Mm-hmm. So we were really able to like play in these moments, and the relationship between Francine and Rose always felt like one of the clearest to me, mm-hmm, out of all of the relationships in the family. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just because you're such a good writer. It just made so much sense on the page. But yeah, in that proposal scene, that was actually one of my favorite days on set, because there was just this unspoken anxiety. I don't even know if we really discussed it, because we had been filming for a while up until that point and everything had sort of taken root. And in that moment, like the pressure of the environment that was built for that scene, I just remember that being so painful to film. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In a good way, in a fun actor way, but truly like an excruciating moment, because I think a lot of women at some point, especially young women at some point in their lives, have experienced a moment like that, where society, like the pressure of society, has basically put you into a corner, mm-hmm, where you have to be polite. You feel like you have to be polite. Otherwise, you know, it's all hell breaks loose and you're going to be perceived in a bad light. And so I just thought that was like a really relatable moment. And I think, you know, some young women have come up to us at the screenings, at the festivals, and they've always like had interesting commentary on that part of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You're talking about the proposal scene and stuff, and then the like the perfect, you know, follow up to that is that moment you share, mother daughter, where you're like, I've got to, you know, this is what we're gonna do, and he's okay if I move away, blah blah blah. And Jennifer, your character just kind of, it's not a silent reaction, but you just say, I guess you got it all figured out then. But like the look on your face is like, you feel like she's being so ungrateful, but Rose is just trying to make her own way. And that's why it's so fascinating to me that you said that you actually originally wrote it years ago to play the Rose, because they're basically like two sides of the same coin. But yeah, talk about sort of that moment when you feel like she's let you down, but the audience is like rooting for her to leave.
Yeah, exactly. Again, it comes from, you know, how can Francine, my character, how can she guide her in something she knows nothing about? Francine doesn't know. She didn't have the tools given to her to understand that she could have a life of her own. Because when she grew up, being married was like it. That was what was supposed to happen. And we see that Francine had dreams, but they got squashed. So it's this go and do it, but don't leave me. And if you go and do it, it kind of looks like then I've failed. So there's a real love hate for the situation.
Yeah.
So it's a very fine line. And again, like Emily said, we do get a lot of people that come up to us and speak about, they really get moved by the film and they're touched and they want to talk about it. And that relationship, that mother and daughter relationship, and it could be father and son or mother and son, is a very tricky thing. You want the best for your kid, but then you're afraid for your kid. And that's all happening all at once in that scene.
Absolutely. And we have to, I guess we have to mention, of course, Emily, I think your big scene is, we're not going to spoil what you're talking about, but let's just say you finally call out Dad, played by Dominic Lombardozzi, of course, Herc from The Wire. Like, I mean, it's legendary. I love that you cast him in that. And he's like charming and but kind of sinister underneath. It's kind of perfect.
He's a wonderful, wonderful actor. Wonderful actor.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's buying daughters cars and bakeries. And so you say he becomes lovable. You can see why people would sort of fall for him and love him and the charm. He says, I'm not the monster you think I am. But, you know, based on these allegations on TV, maybe he is. So anyway, but I just wanted to talk about that one scene, Emily, where you finally, when the dad's kind of like, all right, you know, I'm back, or, you know, we're going to act like nothing happened. And you're like, no, we are not. And Jennifer, you're showing these close ups on her face like she's about to boil over, like, I'm not standing for this anymore. But talk to me about that scene, Emily.
Yeah, I think that it all comes to a head. And, you know, it's just she can't live the lie anymore, or I don't think she will survive. Like, we won't spoil anything, but there's, if time jump a little bit before that scene, before she has that confrontation with the dad, I truly think Rose is on the edge of survival, whether she can mentally sustain this life, because it is making her sick in some ways, just being a part of it. And I think what happens is, she reaches a maturity in this moment where she realizes she does have a choice and people do have the choice, but that choice is not really a win in any way, because the choice is, do I do what's best for me and lose possibly the people that I love, but protect myself and my survival? Or can I stay in this environment for the sake of being around people that I love? And I think that's such an impossible choice, but there was one right choice in that moment.
Yeah.
So I think that conversation between them, it was just so excruciatingly painful, because it was the point of no return. Yeah. There was no more, well, I don't know, maybe I can be a part of this. Maybe I can forgive. Maybe I can pretend. This was the point in her life where she made that choice.
Absolutely.
And she decides that she's not, well, I won't say what happens, but she makes a choice.
And again, it's a very relatable piece of like, sometimes the people around us, or sometimes the people we love, they're just not the best for our lives. And that is a very, very painful thing to see, to digest, to understand, and then, like she said, whether or not you do something about it, especially when they're your family. So I wanted to create, look, the thing that's different about this, I didn't want to make anybody a hero. I didn't want to make anybody a villain. Nobody is all good and all bad. I think the what we're missing most in our movies and TV shows today is the humanity. And I did not want to portray Dad as bad and Rose as good. Like, we're all struggling with good and bad every day and how we choose to deal with the situation. So there's those questions that you leave wanting answers to, and it makes you look at your own life. Like, would I be able to distance myself from, even if it was family, who I didn't think was for my own well-being. It's a really difficult thing to swallow.
Absolutely. And it just kind of, that dinner, the table scene that we're talking about when you finally call dad out, it's just, it contrasts to those earlier movies we were talking about, you know, where it's like Sonny's kids will be, James Caan's kids will be in the background and be like, daddy's fighting again, haha, but they're just kids in another room. And here it's, you're literally at the table with them calling him out. And then sort of what you said, there's no good guys, no bad guys in terms of, you know, complex characters. That final scene between you, mother, daughter, it's just a look of acknowledgement and maybe a slight hand wave, but it's, I just commend you all for saying so much with, in these moments without words all necessarily. It's really well done.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. And I just want to say something about that scene too, that you spoke about around the table. Yes, I wrote it. I directed it. I'm in it. I also mostly paid for it, just so everyone's clear. And I'm saying this because we were a small independent film and no one really cared to back a movie that was written, directed by a female about females in the mafia. It's still very much prevalent in 2024, but we had 22 days to film the movie you saw, and we had 4 time periods. And I think Emily had 2 takes at that last scene. So that really, really goes to show the talent and the conviction of every single one of these brilliant actors in this, and just a solid story about human beings in this particular family.
Yeah, and to commend you, at, you know, your filmmaking, for putting on the filmmaking hat too. Like you said, so many different time jumps, but it never feels jarring, where it just kind of seamlessly moves. You know, you'll flash a new year, a new decade on the screen, but it's seamless. And then, you know, just to commend you for trying to think how else you manipulate time. Oh, the big scene when Rose is like having a breakdown in the car after a major incident happens later in the movie. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're crying your eyes out. I love the choice, Jennifer, how you kind of flash back. Well, not really flash back. You flash forward almost at, you know, grieving families, etc. There's like these images, but then we come back to the car. Like, I thought that was a really fascinating nonlinear way to do it. What was the idea behind that?
I really, there was a lot of things that I did with sound and with stillness, because I always wanted Emily to feel, and for us to feel, her suffocation. So if you notice, I kept going back to like black screen during that time. So it was, I want you to be in her world. So she was at the point after a very dramatic event, and she is going in and out of her life, going in and out of her history, her past, seeing the pain of the future, seeing, you know, what was going on around her. And in those moments, you know, I took out a lot of sound, and, you know, it was kind of being in her anxiety, her panic attack, and her mind. And that was always, always, always my note to my DP, to everyone, was like, we are in Rose's brain. It was also my note to my composer in making that beautiful score. It was, I didn't want a score that was going to tell you how to feel or dictate an emotion. I wanted the score to be the inner life of Emily, of Rose. So it was like those broken violins and, you know, so that's where that came from. It was all for absolutely a reason, and a reason being to get inside of Rose's heart.
I love it. I love it. It's so internal and intimate, and so much of the typical mafia violence and all the whackings and everything that usually is salacious is sort of mostly left off screen. You know, obviously it comes to a head towards the end, but yeah, mostly it's just the family drama, and I really, really dug it.
Thank you. I'm Bradley Trainer,
and I'm Don McClain. We have a podcast called Blinded by the Item.
A blind item is gossip about a celebrity with their name left out. It's a guessing game, and you can play along. The item might be like, this A-list star carries a Birkin bag worth more than the average person's house to the gym to work out.
Pretty sure that's J-Lo.
And P.S. the person behind all of this is Kris Jenner,
LLC. We drop a new episode every weekday so the fun never ends.
Blinded by the Item. Listen wherever you get podcasts and watch us on the Blinded by the Item YouTube channel.
Let me think. Let me talk about, I guess, sort of your, before we run here, like the your journey as a director, because I believe this is your debut, right? This is your directorial debut and writing for the feature.
Yeah, it's my first feature of writing and directing, producing everything. So yeah, it was, you know, it was years and years of, I wanted to go to film school when I got out of high school, and I wanted to go to NYU, and my family couldn't afford it. And I didn't see any female filmmakers. Like, there was no representation. So I thought maybe that's not for me, but I wanted to tell stories. I knew that. And I thought, you know, going to acting school, I can tell stories through it as being an actress. And I learned very quickly that that really wasn't my role. My role was to tell other people's stories and really not say much. And for years, it just wasn't fulfilling. It didn't sit well with me. And I always felt like there was something else I was supposed to be doing. So it took a lot to shift gears and believe that I could do it. But yeah, this journey has been one of the most difficult, but the most rewarding, 100%. So yeah, it's my first feature.
I'll say that, I mean, having worked with Jennifer, I'll put it simply, it feels like the way that it should be, working with a director. It's an experience I can't believe I even got the opportunity to have at this point. And the way that you handled everything, including playing a major part that is going through all these things, which is a full-time job as an actor, mm-hmm. and everything else, and just holding the ship down and guiding us to this point, it's just, I'm very inspired by you. So yeah, she's incredible.
Thank you. And that, yeah, well, I'm glad you enjoyed, you know, their experience on set working for, you know, as a co-star and a director and writer. But I want to know, you know, even before this movie, when you first found out, you know, you might audition for it or whatever, did you have a favorite Jennifer Esposito role as an actress? Like, when did you first discover her on screen before all this?
Okay, you know,
I don't even know this. I'm excited.
She's going to kill me for this.
Go for it. No wrong answer.
No, there isn't.
When I first saw it, my brain, because I'm a child in the brain still, you know, was like, the master of disguise.
Oh my God.
And then my mom goes, no, Emily, Summer of Sam. And I went, oh right. Yeah.
And I was like, Dana Carvey, oh, Spike Lee.
Because I hadn't seen that movie in a while, but I watched that movie with my parents growing up, and it's like a crazy film, and you're so amazing in it. But I will say, like, that was my first instinct as, like, you know.
It's hilarious. It's
That's
like
totally okay. No wrong answer.
Guys, that girl in Masters of Disguise, she wrote a mafia film. It's like, I don't know, do we trust this?
That's Rain.
I trusted it. That was the vote of confidence I need. I was like, absolutely. Are you
That's
kidding?
Great. That's yep. great.
Yep. That's hilarious. Well, that's for me, great. Obviously, my mind immediately went to Crash, maybe because it's the 20th anniversary, 2004, right? Was when it came, yeah. started hitting the festival circuit. And we had Hilary Swank on to do a couple weeks ago, 20th anniversary of Million Dollar Baby. But anyway, so I was just wondering, memories of that really fast. I promise it's the only, you know, past role we'll talk about, because there's no time. We want us to talk about Fresh Kills. But man, I just thought that movie, not only did it capture post 9/11 sort of prejudice that was going on, but it was like a Robert Altman-esque, like, you know, ensemble cast with Don Cheadle and Terrence Howard and Andy Newton and Matt Dillon and Sandra Bullock, Brendan Fraser, Ludacris. I mean, the list goes on and on. Michael Pena goes on and on. But yeah, just memories of it real quick for you.
Fast and Furious. I think my part was filmed in 1 week. And I, no joke, I remember getting the script and reading it within, I think it was maybe 25 minutes, because I was inhaling it, because there's so many, there's so many things you get, and you're just like, what's happening here? It was exactly what you saw on screen was exactly on the page. And I remember walking in to meet Paul Haggis and saying, this is going to win an Oscar. And he said, from your mouth to God's ears. And I said, okay, I'm telling you. And sure enough, it won the Oscar for best feature. It was, listen, getting great material, there's nothing better. There's nothing better than getting great material. But unfortunately, that's not always the case. But that was great material.
Oh, absolutely. I'll never forget it. And it was, you know, I guess a lot of people nowadays are like, oh, you know, how did that beat Brokeback Mountain? I mean, both great movies, but I don't want, yeah. My point is I don't want Crash to get lost. And yeah, even if you're listening to this and think, yeah, Brokeback should have won, whatever. That was a great freaking movie. Brokeback was amazing. Absolutely. But I want to say, don't let Crash get lost in the shuffle with these, yeah. You know, hindsight Oscar conversations. Because the cast we just named launched all these careers, like future Oscar winners in that thing. Yourself, of course. And then like the songs like Bird York's In the Deep and Stereophonics, Maybe Tomorrow in the credits. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it was great. It was really great. I agree with you.
Great. I mean, it's no Master of Disguise, but
that's true.
Hey, look, you be clear. Do not slander that film. It's perfect.
Can I tell you how many young people love? Like, I get so many people coming up to me like, oh, I loved you in that movie because they were all children and they were watching this. And honestly, I made that movie for that reason because it was right. It was literally right after 9/11. And like my father was in the buildings, thankfully he got out, but like it was a very scary time, obviously. And I started to say, just like many of us were saying, like, what does this all mean? Like, what, you want me to go and do what? You want me to go do a movie? Like, do you know the world's falling apart and Hollywood doesn't stop? And I was like, I don't want to do anything. And then I thought, had a young niece, and I thought she was so frightened. And I thought, well, maybe I can do this and make a kid smile in this insanity. And that's why I did it. And I actually did it because it made a lot of children really happy back then. So, yeah.
A lot of adults happy. Trust me. I would watch it this weekend and it would just make my life.
That's so great. That's so great. That's
turtle,
awesome.
Turtle. Yeah. I mean, come on.
Dana Carvey, come on.
And Dana Carvey was awesome.
Hey, we had him call in. If you get a chance, look up in our archives on this podcast. He came on a couple months ago, and his Biden impression is incredible. His Trump is incredible. He basically did Master of Disguise. You just sit back, turn the microphone off, and let Dana Carvey just
exactly
do a million characters.
He's awesome. So that was another reason. It was like I loved him. So,
but I didn't realize your dad was in the tower. I mean, we're talking about Crash as opposed to 9/11. I didn't realize he was in the towers. Anything you want to expand upon on that? How he got out?
Well, I'll tell you, it was why it was equally crazy. It was the first time I was like in Italy and I was with my cousin and our fathers are brothers and they both worked at the towers. And we were sitting in like a piazza somewhere. I think we're in Florence. And the waiter said in broken English, so you from America? And we said, yes. He said, your buildings just fell down. And we were like, what do you mean buildings? Your two twin buildings. And we were like, our dads worked there. What are you talking about? So we ran back to the hotel and, you know, it had already happened. So the way they were showing it, it was just like things hit and fell. So we were like, they're dead. They're definitely dead. They're dead. Now, what do we do? And we couldn't get home. We were stuck overseas. It was a nightmare. And that is when my niece had called me. We spoke and she was probably 6 at the time. And she said, Aunt Jen, can you please walk home? Because I'm afraid you're going to get on an airplane and fall down. And that's seriously remembering that. And then hearing my agent literally a week after 9/11, like, hey, they got this job for you. And I was like, are you serious right now? But I thought of my niece and I thought, this is what you can do. Go do it. So yeah, it's pretty crazy. But our fathers did wind up making it out of the building. They wind up hiding in a basement across the way. Yeah, it was horrible. It was horrible.
I can't even imagine you at some point, as soon as airports reopen, having to get on an airplane and fly back to New York.
It was I said the same thing, and they wind up flying me privately because I was petrified. But flying back from Italy was horrendous. It was the one of the most frightening experiences. Yeah, it was pretty horrendous.
Wow, that's so wild. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that story. But yeah, just to, I guess to bring it back around to Fresh Kills. I mean, you'd mentioned earlier in the interview that, you know, you sort of grew up and, you know, you said you knew people like these wives and these daughters and sisters and things in when you were growing up. So how can we say, I don't want to ensnare anyone in any, you know, legal trouble or whatever, if you want to speak ambiguously, yeah. But you know what I mean? If you can elaborate more on just sort of what you mean by that, like you grew up around it.
Yeah, no, I grew up, it was a very mafia heavy neighborhood, and the girls of these families were my in my class, in my neighborhood, in my friend group, and the violence and the rage that I saw from them, more so than the boys, stayed with me, really stayed with me. And I am a very big why person. Like, I need to answer those why questions in my brain. They keep me awake at night. So after I left Staten Island when I was probably 17, 18, and that stayed with me. And I didn't understand. I chalked it up to, well, I guess if your family's in the mafia, you'd be pissed off. But then as I started to go on with my life and be female and then be put into a box in the business is she's this, not that, or you're this and not that, and know there was a ceiling over my head that I was going to hit one day, that rage that I saw in them, I started to recognize in myself. And I finally realized what it was. It was less about them being their fathers or whatever in the mafia. It was that they were born into something that they did not choose.
Right.
And it was about choice, and they had none. And
Rose says that in the movie, you know, I didn't choose this. So.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, bravo on the film, both of you. And I really enjoyed this conversation. It was really wide ranging. We covered a lot in a little time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Jason. Yeah, no, we I just want to say to everyone who's listening, seriously, making independent films, they are one of the most difficult thing. And if you really want to see every voice, every story represented, it is so vitally important to participate and support independent storytelling, because it really isn't hard. And especially seeing different voices and female voices. Like I said, I was offered $5 million to step aside for a male director, and I said no. So
glad you didn't take that money.
Thank you. We'd love the support.
Awesome. Again, everyone, it's called Fresh Kills. It's playing at the Annapolis Film Fest in Annapolis, Maryland on Friday, April 5th. Come see it there. And then, you know, it opens wider, you know, in theaters later this spring. Jennifer Esposito, writer, director, star, and actress Emily Bader, thank you so, so much for joining us. Congrats. I really, truly, I'm a huge movie buff, and I truly believe it's a great flick.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it. And we can't wait to come to Annapolis.
Yeah, it looks so cute. I'm so excited.
So you will be doing like a Q&A and stuff after the movie?
Yes, we will. We will.
All right, everyone, bring your questions. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much for listening to Beyond the Fame with Jason Fraley. Our theme music is Scott Buckley's Clarion. Remember to give us a 5-star rating if you like what you hear. We'll see you next time.